So I am back together with David Sorrell, Dr. Sorrell, our Director of Clinical Training, who is in isolation at home, as we all are. And so we've found a window when we can have a chat. And welcome back to the podcast, Dave. It's slightly unusual situation, but you're keeping well, I hope.
Yes, I'm 50% self-isolating and 50% still seeing patients at urgent care. I've just finished the three-day stretch, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, which was actually very busy, which was actually quite good to be busy. The last couple of weeks have been very quiet, which is disconcerting really for me.
Yeah, it has been a bit weird. I did Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Saturday felt like a normal day in terms of volumes of people. So that kind of initial isolation period where everyone stayed at home, I think is starting to, and it's probably tailing with the improved numbers that we're getting here in New Zealand. I mean, we're recording this on Wednesday the 15th, and today there's been no further deaths, and I think 14 probable cases and only 6 confirmed. So the curve is definitely coming down, and I think as people are hearing that, they're starting to feel more comfortable going out into clinics. But also, I think if you spend a couple of weeks indoors not addressing medical concerns, they eventually get to the point where you have to be seen. So there definitely seems to be an improvement of patient numbers of late, which is good because clinics need to be busy. So how, apart from being on the quiet side, how has your experience been so far in terms of the response?
Well, it's been very interesting. Obviously, there are the testing clinics or CBAC clinics or COVID clinics that have been exceptionally busy, pretty much concentrating on testing. And then you've sort of got the separated urgent care. And now what we have is the hybrid clinic that have zones of the red zone being the unwell patients with possible COVID type symptoms. And there's some interesting literature coming out. I read something today talking about redefining asymptomatic, and the infectious diseases experts saying that what we're really talking about is pre-symptomatic, and that you don't necessarily know whether a patient is asymptomatic because they read that they're supposed to have a fever and shortness of breath, but they could be pre-symptomatic presenting with other symptoms, which is very, very common, especially in the early stages. So someone might come in with tummy pain and diarrhea and be a COVID case. So a lot of it is risk management, saying, and it's all very well to say it's less likely, but it's very hard to retrospectively PPE. So I have a very low threshold to putting on all the equipment while I'm reviewing and interviewing the patient. And then consider your diagnosis. But it's too late if you've exposed yourself for half an hour with the patient without PPE and you realize this patient is a probable case. So my normal PPE for patients who do not have any signs, symptoms, and I don't think they have it, is gloves and mask and, of course, scrubs. And I have clean and dirty clothes, and I don't wear my work clothes at home anymore. So I've adopted a lot of the ED protocols personally, even though I'm not working in the emergency department. But it's all about risk management, I think.
Yeah, it certainly caused a change in practice. And I'm the same. I'm wearing scrubs at work, no socks, wearing Crocs even, which go straight in the wash, straight in the bleach when I get home, and trying not to bring anything home. And I think that's probably something that going forwards from here is actually good practice for any work day, really. You know, you don't want to be bringing home any bugs of any kind, but during a pandemic, it's obviously more important. How have you been managing in terms of virtual things? Have you been doing much virtual consultations? Have you been car park consults?
I know there are a lot of people doing virtual consultations, but I haven't. There are other people who do that for our organisation, and we're set up to be the front line seeing the patient situation. I have been sending hundreds of texts for negative COVID results via our system and recording those, but that doesn't really allow for time to, you know, talk and review the patients. I think that's something that needs to be worked on, and especially from what I'm reading, that you need to keep in touch with your patients. And the question is, who is going to be doing that? Is it going to be their GPs? Is it going to be the urgent care clinics? Is it going to be the hospitals? It's a challenging time for working out everyone's place. I think to some extent it's possibly brought maybe general practice and urgent care closer together, but only time will tell with that.
Yeah, I've certainly found that then in terms of virtual consults, I've been phoning people in their car and taking a history. And then that when they come in, the examination is quite quick. So we're not spending as much time in the room. Even if you're wearing PPE, you can get a lot of that information that you would normally glean from them in the room with them. You can get that out the way over the phone beforehand so that your actual physical exposure time is less. And I think that's quite a good way of using communicative tools to aid in the consultation, but it's quite hard to necessarily diagnose over the phone unless you're directing somebody somewhere. So you're directing them from home to a testing station or to ED or whatever. From the perspective of GPs doing virtual consults, what's been your experience of patients coming through urgent care who were having virtual consults with their GP, who then decided they wanted to be seen? Have you been seeing many of those?
So I think we've had a few of those. And personally, I had a virtual consultation with my GP a couple of weeks ago. And it's an interesting perspective because urgent care has always been a very face-to-face. And so I think that it's an evolving technology. And I know a lot of others are doing that. And I know the college is going to prepare a position statement on telehealth. And it's still a little bit disjointed, I think, and it needs to be better co-joined. And a lot of the problem is the information transfer is sometimes incomplete, and we don't really know how the consultation virtually has gone. We don't know how the communication's gone. And I think technology needs to improve in how you record all these things. So like if you're in full PPE and trying to do a consultation, the recording of that is an interesting concept. And it would be nice if there's a way to record as you go, perhaps in the technology of voice recognition software and things that will type up the information that you've managed to acquire without touching, because of course that would reduce the risk. But I haven't had that much interaction with the actual information provided via the GP. I've had a lot of patients referred in, but no information about why or what often.
Yeah, it's certainly a difference between general practice and urgent care is the type of patients we see generally are not always appropriate to be telemanaged, whereas a preceding relationship with the general practitioner and a full set of notes is certainly easier to do more over the phone. But you know, if someone's fallen and broken their arm, you kind of need to assess them. And I've found a few that I've talked to over the phone in the car. When I've come to examine them, actually the examination has changed things quite significantly. We still do need to be seeing people. You mentioned just before we started that you'd read a paper in the Medical Journal of Australia today. Was there anything in that that you found useful that you think our listeners should look up?
There are a number of very interesting points in this article. And it was a very reassuring article for the practice that we're doing. And so the important points are the treatment outside a hospital is supportive. There are no good clinical evidence for any specific therapies. So I think that one of the most important things that came up, I'll just scroll down, it's in front of me at the moment, So 80% of infections are mild respiratory illnesses. And so you can't use your normal clinical decision rules, such as your CURB score, et cetera, for assessing how people are going to go. And what you really need to know is that, do they have risk factors for progression? So if they've got multiple risk factors for progression, then if you wait until your decision rule says that they should be admitted with pneumonia, it's probably too late. And so you need to work out a plan, and follow-up for these patients would seem to be important as well. So the median time for hospital admission is 7 days after the symptoms started. And acute respiratory distress syndrome, 8 days. So you've got about 24 hours to get it right. And I think you should risk profile your patients. And if they're at high risk for severe disease, then you should probably make a plan for admit early type things. And also the final words of this article were very good. And it's all about holistic care and the fact that we should try to treat all our patients with utmost respect and give them the best standard of care, irrespective of the setting in which it is delivered, or the existence of any proposed limitations to life-extending interventions. Under no circumstances should the best possible symptom control and compassionate individualized care be denied to any patient affected by COVID-19.
Yeah, very true. What are they, when they say supportive care, what is it that we can do?
And nothing.
Nothing, okay.
That's pretty much it. So obviously treat any underlying conditions. So if the patient is still only a suspected COVID and you're waiting for testing and they have an exacerbation of asthma or an exacerbation of COPD, you would treat that. So you're treating the other condition. COVID itself, there are no supportive care, fluids, keep their normal medicines going, follow them up. In hospital, obviously oxygen is the main therapy and different ways of delivering that tailored to their oxygenation. And then obviously non-invasive ventilation and invasive ventilation. So that's what it comes down to. So the decision as to the dispensation of the patient is a complicated one. And I'm not sure, and obviously encouraging them to ring Healthline for follow-up, and then that can be keyed into what other resources. But it would be quite difficult to be reviewing these patients. I don't think we have systems in play to review your COVID positive patients that work very well at the moment.
But you say there's high risk factors that need to be taken into account.
Yes, so they have a table of the assessment severity scale for COVID, and it's quite a good thing. So mild illness, mild upper respiratory symptoms, and age less than 60, and no major comorbidities. So those are the ones that you're just going to look for. But you're going to worry about your patients with severe shortness of breath, difficulty breathing, and comorbidities. And those are the ones that you should do early referral for hospital. And as I say, I don't think they'll fit into a clinical decision rule that we currently have. That by the time they breach a CURB 65 score, although there are the clinical elements in there, then they really could be struggling. And so I think age greater than 65, comorbidities, and significant symptoms, those would be your three things. And you can look at things like oxygen saturation and respiratory rate, but you've got to be careful not to underestimate these patients.
It is it's a slightly strange time for us here in New Zealand because we are flattening that curve and we haven't had that overwhelming kind of surge on the health system that people are in other countries are having to deal with. So we've still got to be prepared though for, we're not out of the woods yet, are we? And so We've got to be prepared when we see anybody with respiratory symptoms. We've got to be thinking COVID for some time to come now. It's going to impact our decision making with respect to this whole winter. And this journal that you were, this article you were quoting there, is that from, is that an open access paper at
the
moment?
Yes, it is. It is. This one is, I can, you know, send you the link and things, but it's definitely open access, which is unusual for the NGA. But, and it's, it comes in the web version and there's a PDF, which has got a really good table attached to it.
Cool. And that's published in the Medical Journal of Australia, but it's, and is it based on their local data? So it's kind of relatively...
Yes. So it's Australasian, which I think is
Australasia,
quite good, because
okay.
It's not a lot of other Australasian stuff. So that's quite good. I think it relates a lot more to us than, say, the US data.
Hmm. Cool. So we'll link to that. Otherwise, yeah, we'll move on from COVID because it's certainly something that is... there's a lot of it around, and it's quite good to talk about some other things. One thing I wanted to catch up with you before all this started was we put your Burns talk from the boot camp up as a podcast, and you said yourself at the time that this was a shortened version of a much longer talk, and you really just got to the real nitty-gritty. And one of the things that you said during your talk that I sort of noted down as a thing that... you know, an asterisked it, is when you said, what do you put on a burn? You said, it doesn't matter so long as it's not SSD. And I see SSD still in clinics, and I think there's a familiarity with it, and it's one of those things you've always used, therefore let's carry on. And I just wondered if you wanted to take the time just to expand a wee bit on why SSD is so wrong nowadays for burns.
So... that was a virtual quote from the head of the burns unit at Middlemore, that there is almost no circumstances where SSD should be considered your first line treatment. It creates a pseudo eschar across the wound, which is very hard to remove, and it probably, almost certainly, delays wound healing. So there is... almost everything is better than this product, and it's really moved away. It's the last resort in burn management, and so really you should consider all other options before considering that. It is old technology, and it's, you know, all the studies that have been done on it show that everything has a superior outcome. And so I think burns heal despite SSD, not because of SSD. So certainly the 2008 Cochrane review demonstrated that SSD delays wound healing time and increases the need for dressing changes. So that's a quote directly from there. So you can use lots of things instead of it. And I have a document in front of me from EM Docs where they did a review of this, and they said that any topical product is okay. Personally, I quite like using Bactegrav, so that's basically chlorhexidine impregnated gauze. There's unless you happen to be allergic to chlorhexidine, there's no known side effects, and that covers the antimicrobial. So the reason for SSD is to try to have an antimicrobial. But there are more problems with it than there are benefits, and it's once it's there, it's quite hard to remove. And once you put it on for 3 days, you really don't want to put on. It's controversial in pregnancy. It pigments the skin, especially on the face, and so I think burn care should be very, very easy. Use cool, assess, cover, and avoid agents that are not proven to be beneficial.
Is it come to the point now where you'd almost say SSD shouldn't be within clinics? Or do you feel is there still a small case scenario where it's worth having in?
So I think that there is a small case scenario for its use in abrasions that are contaminated, except those abrasions that are contaminated by tar seal. because tar seal will tattoo, so you end up with it. So sometimes it can be useful to put a layer of SSD on for one day for contaminated abrasions, but that's still, and that's probably one of the only scenarios where they still argue about. But there are other options there as well, like adequately irrigating the wound. But there are no strong indications for use in any other situations. And I think that there are, I mean, people say, oh, you know, it's so comfortable to put on the cooled SSD, but you can put anything else on that's cool. You can put Solocyte on and have that in the fridge as well. So that's not really a good enough excuse to be using it. I think we should all move away from it, basically. That's the easiest summary. And think of anything else that you can get that can be used.
And in terms of frequency of dressing changes, do you have rules on how often you're putting, say, Bactigrar, if you've chosen that as your agent? Are you changing that daily?
Well, yeah, you do have to change Bactigrar quite regularly. And obviously what you'd really want to have is some of the silver products that last longer. But unfortunately for many of us, including me, it's not financially available. So if you had a funded dressing option, so that ACC funded, bulk funded your dressings or something, then I would use Aquacel AG or Acticoat, because you can leave them on for long periods of time. I think Aquacel AG you can just leave on until it falls off. If you have the financial resources to use those longer term dressings and decrease the dressing changes, that's a great idea. The key times to reassess burns are day 3 and day 10, in my opinion, because you can assess the depth of the burn, the perfusion, much better at those stages, and then healing at day 10, so that you can get a second opinion if at day 10 it's not healing much at all, to assess whether anything else needs to be done to the burn.
And I think you covered this in your talk, but blisters, to pop or not to pop is still a very...
That is the question.
...contentious, yeah. So you had
a Shakespearean quote, really, to pop or not to pop. So, again, the head of the burns unit at Middlemore said that questions that are asked are blisters and SSD, and there is no real strong evidence for any particular management of blisters, pop, deflate, and deroof. But deroofing is quite painful. I know that one of our colleagues, who is a fellow now and working in the UK in the emergency department, have strong protocols for deroofing burns very early on. And I don't think that we feel quite as strongly. If you have large blisters that are causing a problem or are overlying joints, they should definitely be at least deflated. And if it's grossly infected, they certainly should be deroofed. But otherwise, I'm quite happy with just deflating, snipping the corner of these burn blisters and letting them come down, because they're going to fall off by themselves fairly soon anyway, and they're not going to delay healing. So it's and often you'll see blisters on day one and you'll leave them and dress them, and the next day they've burst and deflated anyway, and so that makes management quite easy. It takes the decision away from you.
Cool. So yeah, if anyone hasn't listened, they should pop back and have a listen to your talk. The Jackson burn wound model is worth learning, and your Princess Bride quote is how I now remember that. So it's worth going along and having a listen to that. The other thing I wanted to just catch up on, again, pre-COVID, we did a little bit on the Seymour fracture. And when I sent that through for you to check before we put it up, you'd had a Seymour fracture that day, which was a very nice example of it. So what are your thoughts about the Seymour, and how easy do you think it is to actually miss?
Well, it's very easy to miss if you don't look for something. And so whenever you see these, sort of what you're looking for is the nail bed abnormality, and it can be really quite subtle. So whenever you get a circumstance where you've had the crushed fingertip, the child in the car door, etc., you should always be doing an x-ray and then interpreting it. Because I was ready to do a procedure on that teenager with the Seymour injury, and then I saw the x-ray and thought, well, no, this is something that really needs to be done in an appropriate environment. And I know that some people have opinions about reducing these, but there's the reduction and then there's the nail bed injury that needs to be taken seriously separately. And so it is only those who have growth plates that actually have the Seymour fracture. But there's also the consideration of the displaced fracture in the sort of shaft of the distal phalanx, which disrupts the nail plate as well. And those ones probably should be managed the same way as well, with a realignment and accurate nail bed repair. So when you see a deformity, so usually it will look quite humped over the nail bed and just not quite right. And the male, maybe a male plate dislocation or maybe not, but always x-ray, always look at the lateral and see that the growth plate lines up properly. Otherwise, you know, things will not go well.
I think my practices tended to be to refer them to the hand surgeons when I see a Seymour. It is tempting to think about ring blocking and reducing it, but the issue is the nail bed tissue gets sort of opposed into the growth plate, and then that causes a delay in the fracture healing. In your experience, if you did push on these and they go back to a more anatomical norm and maybe even a radiographic norm, does that improvement exclude the presence of nail bed tissue in there, or does that then need to be surgically explored? And therefore, the upshot of that would mean we shouldn't even try and reduce it because it's going to need surgical exploration anyway.
Well, yeah, that's exactly the situation. I'm just scrolling through a whole lot of things that have popped up which relate to it. It's always, I'm not quite expert enough to say, well, if I've reduced it perfectly, does that mean that doesn't need to happen? And I think it's a difficult question to answer. So basically anything that looks like a mallet, get the x-ray and then get a hand surgeon opinion on repair.
It is tricky because you may have done plastics before you come into urgent care, and it may be that you then think, oh, I can reduce that and do it. But I imagine it would take quite a long time, and time is obviously a factor in an urgent care clinic, because if you're taking an hour and a half to do a procedure, well, who's seeing all the other patients? And so we've always got to be thinking of that side of the equation as well. The tools we might have, we might not need anything more than a ring block and a good light source and a few a sterile field and some stitches and stuff, but ultimately, should we be doing it, and do we do it frequently enough to be good at it, whereas a secondary and tertiary referral center, they get good at doing these things because they're doing all of them. So it's a balance between those, and I tend to fall on the side of refer, because if I can't guarantee doing it 100% right, it's, in a kid in particular, it's not just not worth that risk. It's better to go to the surgeon. It's what they're paid for, and we'll carry on seeing the rest of our cohort.
Yes, that's what I would say.
From have you seen any negative outcomes? Like, have you come across anyone who's done badly after a Seymour?
I don't think I've seen enough. I've certainly referred all the ones that I've seen in. And that would be something that I guess the hand surgeons would know more about than us.
It's interesting, going back to COVID sort of backtracking onto COVID again, I saw somebody recently who'd broken their hand, and because of the lockdown had felt, oh, it's just bruised, I'll leave it because I don't want to go to a clinic, I don't want to be around people. They assumed that we'd be really busy and whatever, so they stayed at home until about 10 days later, when it was still hurting, and someone convinced them to go in and get checked. And the problem was it had already started to heal, and they had a fair bit of scissoring on making a full fist. And so it was not through any clinical mismanagement. It was the patient, I guess, trying to be good and or trying not to be difficult or obstructive in this time, who ended up with something. When I spoke to the hand surgeon about what to do, they were going to discuss and call the patient the next day, because it wasn't clear whether it needed something doing now or is it going to resolve with time. And I wonder how many people may have slammed a finger in a door and gone, oh, well, it just looks bruised, I'll leave it. And actually they've got a little underlying seymour or something because of the COVID. So we may have some of these come out of the woodwork in the next few weeks.
Well, I've already been seeing lots of people who present with that scenario, in that they've definitely left things a bit longer. And so we're already seeing that a lot. So your average person's coming in at least 2 days after the injury, not on the same day or the next day. And again, I've seen people a week, 10 days down the track with significant injuries already that have to be followed up and referred. So I think that's something that we've got to be aware of at the moment, and certainly give positive feedback to our patients who are coming in. It's good that you came in. We did need to assess this, and we did need to evaluate it properly.
Okay, so that's about the half an hour mark, Dave. As I said, before COVID interfered and with schedules and things, we were going to try and do more regular chats, and certainly that's the plan. Yeah, as I say, we hope to touch base with you, Dave, more frequently, particularly now that you're 50% of your work is being done at home, and it gives
a great opportunity to be able to do things when time allows, rather than the time I would normally be driving around Auckland, which is the biggest problem I find. That I can finish something and 5 minutes later be on the line to you, rather than scheduling around a 30 to 45 minute motorway trip.
So we will be in touch again, Dave. We'll catch up with you anon. But in the meantime, thank you for finding the time, and I hope you stay well and don't catch anything viral.
Okay. Pleasure to talk to you.
Cool. Thanks.